Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, the new letters editor at The Washington Post, very exciting, and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am hanging in there.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends again.
Before we get to cons and nons, I just want to remind folks that we'll be in D.C. for a live taping on Tuesday, April 9th at 7 p.m. at the Bryant Street location of the Alamo Drafthouse, where we're going to be screening and discussing Denis Villeneuve's Arrival. Love that movie, Arrival. Tickets are about two-thirds gone. They're going fast, folks, so pick them up. They're only, I think, $7, so it's not a huge burden on you. You'll get to watch a good movie, hear some good discussion. It'll be fun. What remains of the tickets are mostly in the front sections. And I know some people are like, oh, that's too close to the screen. I don't want to sit there. But again, I want to remind you that that means you'll be closer to us during our live taping. But I've also become a convert to those seats in recent years. You really get the immersive cinematic experience that way, right? Just a couple weeks ago, I saw Love Lies Bleeding in the second row at a draft house near me. And it was like watching the movie in lesbian IMAX. It was amazing. My field of vision was totally dominated. I loved it. I loved being dominated by the... Anyway, Peter, I know you have thoughts on this seating arrangement. Go.
Yeah, so I just want to put in a word for those front seats. If you think that you are going to be too close or that you're not going to like them, this is a movie where being close and being immersed makes for a better and bigger experience. And so I think Arrival is a movie that benefits from this. But there's something else that you might not know, which is that the Alamo makes those front row seats even better in a special way. So what the Alamo does is they have reclining seats. And the closer you sit to the theater, the more it reclines. So those close-up seats recline more than the ones in the back. And that makes the viewing angle just right in a way that the Alamo just thought of everything. And so I just want to I want to encourage you, don't feel like, oh, those seats are too close. It's going to be too much. You're going to get to sit closer to us. You're going to get to sit closer to the movie. And the Alamo has thought of your neck craning problem in advance and solved it for you.
Like Peter said, sit close, feel comfortable sitting close. You'll be fine. It'll be great. You can tilt back a little more. We love it. Love to see you there. Make sure you get a drink with us before or after. We'll be around. All right. First up in controversies and non-troversies, are kids today, those kids, are they wholly uninterested in the history of cinema? Or is this simply the natural state of affairs? There was a fun debate on Twitter this weekend, kicked off by a professor. He said he made a reference to The Matrix in a lecture. None of the kids got it. Someone replied to this by saying they totally believe it. Kids in the 90s loved movies that were made 30 or 40 years ago, but kids these days, darn whippersnappers, they don't watch anything old. And then someone replied to that by saying, that's insane. Kids in the 90s weren't watching movies in the 1950s and the 1960s. And then we were off. Everybody's arguing about all sorts of different things. Now, The Matrix specifically is kind of an interesting touchstone here, right? It came out 25 years ago, which means that the equivalent when The Matrix came out would be something from 1974. And that means films like Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, The Godfather Part II, The Longest Yard, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Chinatown, Death Wish. Lots of good movies there. Lots of really interesting stuff that kids watched and loved. I know I watched a number of those in my teenage years. Not all of them, but a number of them. And I guess it just depends on what kind of kid you are, right? I do not think I am necessarily typical, but I also don't think these are crazy titles for teenagers to have watched. The further back you go, the dicier it gets, of course. I mean, like the 1950s and 1960s, undoubtedly, lots of great filmmakers there. And I'm sure there are kids who are really into Hitchcock and John Wayne. I could be persuaded that the average non-cinephile teen wasn't out there seeking like Dr. Strangelove and stuff. I did. Again, not necessarily typical. The Matrix in particular, again, is particularly fascinating as a reference point because I can see it both ways, right? On the one hand, it's a movie where the influence is so overwhelming on American action cinema that you basically can't understand modern action filmmaking without understanding the impact of that film. You can draw a pretty straight line from it to the world of John Wick, and not just because the both star Keanu Reeves, and not just because John Wick director Chad Stahelski was Keanu Reeves' stunt double on the film. It just has suffused the look and the feel of action cinema. On the other, though, The Matrix came out at a very weird in-between moment for internet culture. Lots of people were online, but society wasn't really online, right? There was a split between real-life personas and online personas. The simple technology of hard lines and dial-up were different from what would come when everybody has now access to the internet in their pocket all the time. For folks who lived in the before and the after, folks like me, say, again, it's a seminal text. For someone born in the age of tablet and the Netflix and the Facebook and the TikTok, right? It has to be kind of incoherent. Like, why are they plugging into things? What is happening? I don't understand. But I think both of these points are kind of related. Okay, hear me out. I think kids in the 90s were more likely to watch older movies, if only because the world of television that existed for them was more amenable to forcing them to watch older movies. Today, kids choose to watch whatever they want, and those choices are kind of prescribed by what's available on Netflix and Disney and HBO Max. This is how my kids watch stuff, right? They turn on Disney Plus and they watch Phineas and Ferb. They turn on Netflix, they watch Miraculous, whatever. Back in the day, you turned on a TV and you watched whatever was on. And you turned the TV off if you didn't want to watch whatever was on. And what was on basic cable, from AMC to TCM to TNT, et cetera, was a much broader range of movies from a much broader timeline. Just now, just like a few minutes ago, I pulled up a site listing movies by decade on Netflix. There were zero movies from the 1940s on Netflix right now. There is exactly one from the 1950s, White Christmas. There are two from the entire decade of the 1960s, The Guns of Navarone and Prince. Now, there are 46 from the 1970s, 57 from the 1980s, but you add all those up, that's 156 movies total made before 1990 on the streaming service Netflix, which is the biggest streaming service in the entire world. What are the odds that random 16-year-olds are like, you know what, I really want to watch The Deer Hunter tonight. I'm gonna turn that on Netflix. I don't think it's that likely. So let's take this in two parts, okay? Alyssa, are you distressed that the children aren't watching Key Zennial Text The Matrix like they should be?
To sound like a crazed social conservative for a minute, there's a very important figure missing from this conversation, and that's parents. I mean that not in the sense that parents are censoring what kids watch. In fact, I think it's become vastly harder for them to do that thanks to the internet. But growing up, the people who introduced me to movies, especially when I was young, and who sort of curated them for me, were my parents, right? And so I've talked a lot on this podcast about how I really sort of grew up on Buster Keaton movies as opposed to broadcast television or cable. And that was entirely because my parents went out and got VHS box sets of Buster Keaton movies and sat down and watched them with us. Like my, you know, they were the ones who explained to me, you know, how amazing it was that he was doing his own stunts in an era when that was much more dangerous to do, and how he sort of invented, in some ways, the possibility of the action movie. You know, I definitely watched a certain amount of stuff that was just informed by my parents' college tastes. And so even before I watched the James Bond movies, I watched Our Man Flint and In Like Flynn, which were these sort of, you know, riffs on the Bond movies, like kind of, and sort of the Goldfinger era Bond movies turned up to 11. It wasn't that it was, you know, broadcast television or basic cable or the internet that was curating my taste in older movies. It was my parents. So it's kind of bizarre to me to think that people our age, you know, for whom the Matrix was a huge touchstone, our kids are, I think, a little too young for that movie, substantially too young in my case.
Yeah.
But how are parents just not showing their kids anything that was cool when they were young? I mean, the New Yorker's former television critic, now features writer Emily Nussbaum, actually spends a lot of time crowdsourcing older movies to watch with her kids and sort of reports back on how they like them. And it, you know, obviously Emily is not typical in many ways, among them her brilliance, but, you know, that is clearly a family ritual where they sit down and watch like a good, unusual movie that in some cases none of them had seen before every week. And the idea that kids not only aren't watching older stuff, but aren't having this sort of intergenerational bonding experience with their parents is super depressing to me. That should be one of the great things about being an adult, is getting to share the stuff that you really loved with your kids.
Yeah, there's definitely some of that. And I think that is true to a certain extent, though. I was talking with a friend of this show about showing his kid The Matrix, and he said that his son checked out at minute like 35 or something, you know, because it was just just boring. It didn't get to the chase quick enough for him.
I'm sorry, but if the kids today don't get a chance to look at each other, say, look at his neurokinetics, they're way above normal, and then burst into laughter, they're just missing out. That's really sad to me.
So, Peter, the second question here is about how things are watched. And I do think that this is kind of the aspect of all this that lots of people were skating past. Because, look, it's easy to say, like, oh, kids should be better versed in the classics. You know, this is the constant lament of one generation to the next. Why haven't you read The Odyssey and the Iliad? Why haven't you watched I Love Lucy? Why haven't you seen The Matrix, et cetera? Like, I understand that. But I do think that the change in how people watch things has really impacted the various ways people form their own personal canons.
I think that's fair. One of the complaints I saw in some of the discussion around this was a younger person, I believe, saying something to the effect of, well, how are we supposed to watch it? It's how are we supposed to watch The Matrix, which is kind of bizarre to me because it's one of the most easily accessible movies that you can imagine right now. I mean, maybe along with some of the Marvel films or something, right? The Matrix is not a hard movie to find a copy of, even if you don't own a disc player of any kind. All right. There's just it's there to be watched on streaming, though I guess at some points you might have to pay $3 or $4 or $5 for a VOD rental fee. I do think that there is a sort of learned helplessness around the selections that are made by the streamers. And people have this sense that is what's available and that is all that is available. And that is incorrect. On the other hand, a lot of people had that same sense about what was on television, what was on cable in the 1990s. I certainly knew people who wouldn't, you know, venture out to go to the video store or the movies. They just turned on the TV and watched whatever was on. And you'd ask, well, don't you want to see this? And they'd be like, well, it has been on TV. And so in some ways, I don't think this is new. I think, you know, my sense here is that people who are college age or younger are just watching movies less in some ways, or watching or sitting and watching movies from start to finish, much less than we did, because they have so many other video content types of media that they can consume. There's TikTok and there's YouTube and there's video games and there's also just a huge amount of stuff on streaming, right? But you know, so even people who I know who are not, you know, in college or younger, I talk to, and they just say, well, I watch movies less than I used to. Or maybe I watch movies. I hear this one too. I watch movies, but I turn them on and then I'm scrolling on my phone. And they'll just say this, right? And I can't just sit and watch a movie. I've heard that from people who are even into their mid-30s in the last couple of years. And some of them who just enjoy that, like, kind of hyper-stimulation, you know, not quite focusing on anything, and they feel like that's, well, oh, it's more efficient, you know? I kind of get the idea of the movie, and I'm also able to follow along on whatever's happening on Twitter and maybe watch, you know, a stream of a video game at the same time, and that's their preferred way to consume stuff. And so the thing that the three of us do, and have done for decades, which is to sit and focus on one extended piece of media, to read for an hour or two or watch a movie for 2 or 3 hours. That is just in decline. And there is a whole generation of people whose preferred method is to watch stuff that's short, to kind of multitask in their viewing and consumption, whether it's flipping back and forth between things or whether it is literally just kind of watching multiple screens all at once. And so that is inherently going to mean that people are watching or are spending less time with older movies in particular, because those older movies were made with an assumption that you would sit in a movie theater or maybe at home, you know, on VHS, and you just watch it, and that's what you would do. And that's the main and only thing that you would do. And maybe at some point, you know, it's kind of something like The Matrix, you know, gets played on TNT and it's on in the background while you're making dinner or whatever. Sure, that did happen. But the movie wasn't made with the assumption of that as a use case. And I think that does change things. But it's a little weird to me when I hear people who say things like, well, I wouldn't even know how to watch The Matrix. It's not on my homepage on Netflix or whatever the heck that is. Movies are more available now than they ever were, certainly in the 1990s, where you had to drive somewhere to a video store that only had the specific number of movies that it had. And if you were in a small market, indie films, older films, not things that aren't new popular blockbusters, those were hard to access.
Well, look, this is veering very, very rapidly towards kids these days territory. And I don't want to do that specifically, but I do think, Alyssa, that it is, look, you know, maybe this is just how art forms change and die. People don't have the patience to sit down and watch, you know, an opera, right? They don't have the nobody sitting down and reading epic poetry anymore. That's just not what people do for fun. And I do kind of worry about the same thing happening to movies, even though it's so bizarre to me to think of, because it's the most accessible art form that's ever been made, ever. I don't know.
Well, also, people have the patience to sit down and play video games for hours, right? I mean, this strikes me as not sort of totally true. And even if it's totally true, you know what? It's really bad. It's bad not to be able to concentrate on something. It's bad not to be able to immerse yourself in something. It's bad to be hyperstimulated and distracted and not fully engaged all the time. It's bad. And it's also bad to be so, you know, enmeshed in learned helplessness that you can't, like, Google, where can I watch The Matrix, right? The idea that people want to be just sort of brains in the vat consuming whatever that they're fed is monumentally depressing to me. And I don't think it's inevitable. And I think that surrender to that is kind of gross and should be resisted at all costs. All of which is a way of saying, watch The Matrix, because it might convince you that there's some value to getting off your phone once in a while. I'm an old, just like send me to, you know, the glue factory. I'm elderly. I'm turning 40 this year. Like, but for the love of God, like, learn to sit down for an hour and read a book. Learn to sit down for 2 hours and watch a movie. Like, at the Alamo Draft House, they'll bring you, like, all sorts of legal stimulants, and you can watch the movie and you will have a good time. Just for the love of God.
They won't if you're 17. I'm not even sure that they allow minors into those draft houses. But they'll give
you sugar and caffeine and popcorn and, like, all of the french fries you can eat. And it's just fun. It's bad to be a jittery little rat who can't sit still for 2 hours.
One thing I will say is that Alyssa Rosenberg, younger, yeah. That's a fiery social conservative Alyssa Rosenberg on this show, folks. One thing I will say is that the younger folks that I know who are in their 20s, who are out of college, who are kind of smart oddballs, like, is kind of feel like they're outsiders in the culture for the most part, even if they feel pretty comfortable with themselves. All of them are probably better versed in older movies than I would have assumed, than the folks that I knew in my 20s. And that's because they have access to them, because they know how to Google that stuff and they know how to find that stuff and they've gone out of their way. And I think that for the unusual weird kids who want to be into older stuff, who've always, right, like, even in the 1990s, right, like, you had kids who read the old novels and, you know, watched, had, like, comprehensive knowledge of old television and, you know, old music and that sort of stuff. For that type of young person, they are absolutely reacting against that thing that Alyssa was talking about, that, you know, that they perceive is kind of melting the brains of their generation. And so they're watching a lot of older stuff and they're going out of their way to find time to not be hyper or overstimulated, you know, on social media and et cetera. To be clear, I think that's a relative minority, there is a backlash that is brewing to that tendency.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a controversy that, you know, kids these days, man, can you believe them? Alyssa.
Controversy, kids these days, free yourself from the machines.
Peter.
You should see The Matrix. This podcast was first envisioned after a joint screening of The Matrix. It's the movie that I have seen in the theaters the most number of times. If you haven't seen it, it's a controversy to me personally.
Yeah, kids these days are a controversy. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our bonus episode on moody sci-fi. We could call it, like, sad-fi, maybe. You know, no one can hear you scream in space, but everyone can hear you cry a little bit. So make sure you come by on Friday for that. And now on to the main event. Spaceman, the latest Adam Sandler production for Netflix, directed by Johan Renck, who's probably best known to folks as the director of the Chernobyl miniseries and adapted from the Czech novel Spaceman of Bohemia by screenwriter Colby Day. Spaceman follows Jakub, who's played by Adam Sandler, as he enters the final days of a Czech-run mission to visit a strange purple cloud that has appeared in our solar system. He is the only member of this mission. It's just a one-man crew. And he's keeping in touch with the world via the faster-than-light communication device, the Czech Connect, which his very pregnant wife, Lenka, played by Carey Mulligan, is studiously ignoring since she has decided to leave him. Czech Space Command Commissioner Tuma is played by Isabella Rossellini refuses to relay this message, but the lack of communication is still getting to Jakub, who, in his solace, turns to a giant space spider that crawled out of his face and took up residency in the bathroom of the spaceship. If that didn't clue you in, Spaceman, slightly weird movie in which Adam Sandler talks to a giant CGI spider who's voiced by Paul Dano in a spaceship. It feels less like a space travel movie and more of a therapy movie, right? The giant spider Hanush is filling the role of Dr. Melfi. Hanush wants to understand why humanity feels so lonely, only to realize that it is Jakub himself, not humanity writ large, that feels lonely. Hanush must help Jakub reconnect with his loved ones if he's going to achieve real fulfillment, etc., etc. Alienation from oneself and humanity in general, an obvious thematic point of this film, and there are little touches throughout driving home the idea without didactically dwelling on it, right? The little touch I love most is the way Jakub is forced to promote the mission sponsors on camera anytime he wants to do something, like, say, if he wants to decontaminate his ship because there's a giant spider talking to him and he thinks that's going to get rid of it. He has to say the name of the Bumba, decontamination pesticide thing, or the focus on getting the onboard cameras working again before he's allowed to work on fixing his toilet, the noisiness of which is keeping him up nights and killing his ability to get a full night's sleep. I find this movie fascinating because I don't think it entirely works. But the reason it doesn't entirely work is also the reason, if I had to guess, that it exists, right? So under his production deal with Netflix, Adam Sandler has pretty wide latitude to make whatever he wants. And that usually manifests itself in movies like the murder mystery series or You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah, which stars his daughter Sunny as the bat mitzvah girl. Sandler doesn't often play the straight man, even in what we might call his more serious performances, right? In Funny People, he's still a stand-up comedian. In Punch Drunk Love, he's an awkward goof of the sort he plays in other movies, just like kind of terrifying because it's in a sort of our reality. In Uncut Gems, he's a twitchy addict. There's all sorts of like interesting but still very funny elements to these more serious productions. Here he is the straightest straight man who ever stuck a ramrod pole up his spine. It's not just that he's serious, it's that he does not seem to understand what humor is. I don't think he smiles once in the whole movie. I might be wrong. He probably does. But it's very serious. It's deathly, deathly serious. And whether that's, you know, because the character is depressed or because he's suffered traumas like the death of his father for being a communist informant, or he's simply just not a funny guy naturally, it's hard to say. Point is, the guy is very, very dour. And again, this is why the movie is interesting, even if it doesn't work. What makes America's number one cinematic funny man? And I don't say that jokingly or lightly. Comedic cinema has moved almost entirely to Netflix, and he is king over there, as the streamer's numbers have shown time and time again. Why does the king of American comedy want to examine a lonely cosmonaut's disconnection from humanity and his own family? Why so serious, Adam Sandler? The best performance in the picture, I think, is Paul Dano's voice work as Hanush, which makes some sense because Dano's made a career out of playing weird little guys with interesting voices, like the child preacher in There Will Be Blood and the tortured suspect in Prisoners. Hanush is almost definitionally a weird little guy, and he's got a weird little voice, and he's a giant space spider / therapist. Alyssa, what did you make of Spaceman?
I found it weirdly charming. Like, I'm not sure it works. But it's so odd that I'm kind of glad it exists. I also find it fascinating. I mean, you mentioned that Sandler has chosen to play a character who's not, he's not just playing straight, he's playing dour, right? And he's also, it's interesting to me that they decided to keep the sort of post-Cold War Czech setting where, you know, you have these sort of odd remnants of a different era. You have the sort of oddly underdeveloped, you know, political backstory for Jacob's father. And you have this sort of interestingly post-Cold War aesthetic. I mean, the idea that Adam Sandler was interested in playing not just sort of a depressed astronaut, but like a depressed Czech astronaut dealing with the trauma of the Soviet era is really not what you would expect. I think the movie is a little funnier than you give it credit for, right? Like when, you know, Hanoush, the giant spider thing, basically gets addicted to this giant thing of Nutella, sitting there eating it and talking about how it helps him deal with the sort of general misery of Jakob's character and his emotional failings. Like, that's pretty funny, right? Like, the idea that you would bring, you know, a giant vat of Nutella to, like, your encounter with a cosmic space apocalypse thing. Again, fairly funny. Maybe just the Nutella jokes are good. But it's sort of it is a sort of oddly touching movie. And you didn't talk at all about Carey Mulligan's performance as Lenka. But again, it's kind of nice to have a non-patient female character, you know, in these types of movies, right? Like the sort of like sad man goes to space and encounters his feelings out among the Oort cloud. There's this constant staple of the sort of the woman, the daughter, the wife at home who, you know, who is continuing to be patient and stoic. And to have Mulligan play a character who's like, no, I'm done with this. Like, you made up a reason to get off the phone with me when I had a miscarriage, when you were in space, and I'm going to go have my baby in a fancy spa and you can go F yourself, is sort of an interesting character, which makes the movies very sort of sentimental turn at the end kind of unfortunate. Like, I actually found Mulligan somewhat more interesting here than I did in Maestro, which is partially because I just hated Maestro as a movie in a way that I did not hate this. But there's no denying that it's quite odd. I mean, it's an odd movie. And I was sort of won over by that, but I couldn't mount any sort of defense that it works or is a good idea. It's just so bizarre that it kind of put a fritz in my critical wiring.
Yeah, it's just a very strange movie. And I think points for strangeness can be awarded. I think, you know, again, this is kind of the ideal scenario for which Netflix is good. I don't know that this is the sort of movie that makes sense as a theatrical production. I don't know that it's the sort of thing that, you know, folks would necessarily show up to, but you put it on Netflix, they can spend a little more money on it, and it gets a little more attention than it otherwise would have. I don't know. Peter, what did you make of Spaceman?
Well, like Alyssa said, it's a tremendously odd movie and kind of charming in a way. I think the concept here is one that it's so strange that once you hear it, once you think of it, it's the sort of thing that you think, oh, I guess I would be interested in a movie about that. And I think Adam Sandler is a version of that movie with Adam Sandler could work. But I think this movie has some script problems. It has a really interesting idea that it only sort of knows what to do with. There just isn't that much development of what's going on in the A plot, in the main story, which is Adam Sandler and the Paul Dano spider thing in a spaceship. All of that stuff is just there to excavate his backstory. And that's a weird choice to build a whole big high concept movie where like the high concept thing, there's a little bit of development, but it doesn't really go anywhere. It's mostly just there to talk about the Polish communist relationship stuff. Like what? Like, and I thought, and that was the most interesting stuff in the movie, right? Like, I kind of almost don't want this to be a science fiction movie. I just want this to be an earthly tale of a difficult romance, because every time I thought Carey Mulligan actually gave the best performance here. Every time she's on screen, I thought the movie was much more interesting. And I thought the dynamic there on Earth was just much more interesting than anything happening in the spaceship. And that's because they never really wanted the spaceship stuff to go anywhere. They just wanted to use it as a vehicle to get to investigate the Earth stuff. That's a very odd choice.
The movie is a meme. The movie is a meme. Yeah. Men would rather go to space and hang out with a giant spider than go to therapy.
Yeah, right. So again, it's one of these movies that has like such a strange elevator pitch. Adam Sandler in that Men Will Literally movie. And that you kind of is like, okay, I can kind of get why Netflix bought it, because what Netflix constantly seems to do, especially with some of their smaller projects, is they buy a concept and they buy talent, a star or a name director of some sort. And then I just feel like they never develop their scripts well enough. There is not a supervisor there who can take good ideas and turn them into great scripts. Every now and then, Netflix produces an original film that works on its own that has a great script. I think The Killer's script is actually really quite good in its own way. But most of the time, it just doesn't happen. And it just seems like they're buying talent and concepts without, but then not taking that and like refining those scripts and refining those stories to get to where the movies actually work on their own terms.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always hesitant to ascribe script problems to anything that I haven't read the script or the source material for, which is the case here. I haven't read the novel. So I don't know what got kept and what got taken out. I don't know, you know, I didn't read the script, so I don't know precisely what that looked like. And I think the real issue here is not, I just think the thing is miscast. As Alyssa said, you know, I actually enjoyed watching this in one very specific regard, which is that it is very, very weird. And we have a dearth of weirdness, out there. There's a lot of weird stuff that we could be getting and we aren't. And this is amusingly and enjoyably weird. But
it's conceptually weird is the thing, right? It is constantly hitting you over the head, or at least like hitting you in the face with, this is a weird idea. Does it go to interesting places with its weirdness? I think the problem is that it doesn't. There's just not a lot of, there's not enough world building. There's not enough plot here. It's backstory and feelings that are elevated by a strikingly bizarre concept. And it's that lack of narrative drive and development, especially in the A plot, that makes this movie interesting but kind of inert.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I would say my other issue is with this movie is that I am a therapy skeptic, in the sense that I am not, you know, a huge fan of talking about feelings, believe it or not.
That's why we watch movies together, man.
And this movie is very much like, we're going to do therapy, but it's going to be in space with a big spider. So, you know, that gets you halfway there for me. Space, big spider. Not sold on the therapy necessarily. But all right.
Sonny,
all right, so what do we...
If someone could go to therapy and their therapist was a big talking spider with a Paul Dano voice, would that maybe change your mind about it a little bit?
Well, no, but then it wouldn't be weird. It would just be normal. That would just be regular life. And I wouldn't be interested in that. That would be if imagine The Sopranos, but Dr. Melfi is like three spiders in a trench coat. And it's like, you know, I don't know that would necessarily... You know, that changes things, but in a bad way. So, all right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Spaceman? Alyssa?
I feel like it would be an interesting movie to watch after eating a gummy. So I don't know.
A perfectly legal gummy that is just has some sugar in it.
What on earth are you guys talking about?
Drugs, man!
That's neither a thumbs up nor a thumbs down. Both of you. I'll continue the thread here and go thumb sideways, because again, I like it and it's kind of interesting. It's also, I don't know that it works. This is a you know, it's a weird episode for a weird movie. We'll go there.
This is the best movie to take us, the best spider based movie to watch while on a mind altering substance of your choice that has come out this year. But there are two.
Are we in? Well, no, I guess Dune 2 doesn't count because there's no spider lady in Dune 2. All right,
it's just worms.
All right. This is, I'm calling a cap on this. This is ridiculous. This episode spiraled out of control. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our audio engineer, Jonathan Siri, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If no grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, at Sunny Bunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.